Guys, welcome back. We're live. Phone number to contact the show is 636-487-HAND. Our guest tonight is a professional wrestler whose new memoir, Self-Help, Life Lessons from the Bizarre Wrestling Career of Al Snow, hit shelves today. Al Snow is here, guys. Al, how are you doing?
Mike, Travis, Matt, how are you guys?
Good, Al. What's going on, buddy?
Nothing much. Just was running a little behind, so I apologize.
Al, what...
I wanted to get to an area where I had a good signal so I can call you.
What great timing for the book to come out today, right?
It's been very fortuitous. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm very, very, very grateful. Very happy.
I assume that your social media accounts have been blowing up with Jared Leto stealing your gimmick.
Yes. So a lot of people last night and even today still have been posting pictures and, you know, saying gimmick infringement and, you know, and I just write back, what does everybody want? And, you know, of course he loves a little head and things like that. So,
it's got to be amazing, though, when you see that on the eve of your book dropping, to see your name is being used as a hashtag and because Jared Leto like dressed like a fool at the Met Gala.
Yeah, I know. What was he thinking? I mean, come on. Well, I can't say anything. I've made a career, you know, carrying a head around. So.
Well, and that the Met Gala, I guess everybody dresses in like Halloween costumes and what is that whole thing about?
I don't know. I'm not quite sure. I know, you know, it's the whole representation of living art and, you know, which I get. But I think that.
Oh, it's a living art thing?
I think so. Oh, okay. But I also think it's for these celebrities, the competition, you know, because they make their livelihood on being relevant. And relevancy is a matter of how many people are talking about you right now. And, you know, so they're all going to compete to see who can, you know, did you see the chick that was walking around looking like a candelabra?
That was Katy Perry, yeah.
No, yeah. She was a cheeseburger, yeah. I thought.
No, I think she had costume changes, well, yeah. Matt. She brought multiple outfits to the Met Gala.
She had multiple ones? That's even better.
Yeah. I actually got an invitation to the Met Gala.
Oh, you did?
Did you?
Yeah, I couldn't make it this year. I was going to go, but I had other things going on, so.
You didn't have your Fifth Element cosplay ready to go?
You know, I'm so busy, Travis. Episode 400 and all that.
I get it.
Yeah.
Al, so the book is out today. It's called Self-Help, Life Lessons from the Bizarre Wrestling Career of Al Snow. It's a memoir, kind of, but it's not really, like, billed as a memoir, is it?
Well, it is a memoir. I mean, it's just, you know, it's my life experiences. And quite honestly, the first, what I wanted for the title was how to take shit and make shoe polish and other life lessons I learned from wrestling. because quite honestly, that has, you know, who I am and what I've become is been a product of all of the lessons that I've learned and from the really unique and very different world that I've lived in and grew up in, because I basically became an adult in the world of wrestling. I was 18 when I started.
Yeah, and you, when you were 14, you saw it on TV and just said, that's what I'm going to do. And you just had like a singular focus with no backup plan.
Pretty much, yeah. That's still to this day, I don't have a backup plan.
I
mean,
well, I guess at this point, you don't really need one, right? You've written the book. You're done, right?
Yeah, I'm done.
I'm
going to start doing magic for the blind.
There you go.
Very good.
It's a weird paradox because...
I love card tricks.
I think that good advice would be to have a backup plan, but... You know, to have that singular focus and drive to succeed is probably the only way to get to the level that you got to get to the mountaintop.
I've heard many different trains of thought from many different people. So I'm saying that you shouldn't have a backup plan because you're then you know, you're basically accepting the fact that, that there is a very strong possibility that you may not achieve what you want.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess you'll pull your punches because you have something else you can go do.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it never occurred to me that I wouldn't. And that was, you know, that I broke in at a very interesting time in professional wrestling that, you know, it was during that transitional period of where, we were transitioning from the territories, the regional territorial system back. And a lot of people don't realize that we were going back to a national promotion because we had been there once before prior in the 50s. And then it had broken apart and went back to regional territorial promotions. And then
is that like a lot of high school gymnasiums and stuff, or is that?
But you know that's a big misnomer because it was it's perpetrated a lot, I think, in part by WWE, that like they brought it out of the high school gymnasiums and all that, and nothing could be further from the truth, because if you actually go back and examine it, there were, you know, shows that were performed in high school gymnasiums, but the majority of them were performed in arenas all around the country. Every major city had an arena, and I remember a story of Dick the Bruiser and the original Sheik were competing, they were running opposition against each other in Detroit, in the wrestling business at that time was so popular in Detroit that they had sold out Cobo Hall, which was 10,000 plus, and then had sold with the original Sheik on top, and then Dick the Bruiser had sold out the Olympia, which was another arena across town that was 10,000 plus, and they turned people away from both places and had them wrapped around the corners.
But what was the feeling of that when it transitioned, right? So it went from back from regional back to nationwide. Did you feel any kind of apprehension, or was wrestling on such like a rocket ship at the time that there was no way it could really fail by going national again?
It just was that there were fewer and fewer places for you to be able to pursue, you know, continued employment, you know, like, you know, with the territories active, the biggest thing that you can recognize today is that, back then, one thing is that you can work almost 5 to 7 days a week and primarily almost all of the different territories. The other thing was that, when you had your run in a particular territory, because you got to understand that you're a product, you're a brand, you're peanut butter,
right?
You're a brand, you're a car. When the audience gets, you know, the audience's interest wanes in you, then you can leave and go somewhere else, and you become a brand new product again, and you're reinvigorated and reinvented. And even if you come back and circle around 6 months, a year, 2 years later, back to that original territory, you know, you're brand new again, you're fresh. These days, you know, with it being, a singular national outlet, a lot of, you know, look at WWE, a lot of those people have been, not knocking them, don't get me wrong, they're extraordinary, but, you know, they've been on your shelf.
Right.
You know, Randy Orton's been on your shelf for what, 20 some years now? You know, how many times can you see him? How many different things can he do?
Right.
You know, how many times can you wrestle the exact same, you know, opponents?
Do you feel like that's some of the appeal right now of why there's these different sects of wrestling, these independent channels for people to wrestle in outside of the WWE is starting to be picking up steam?
Yeah, and that was the same as what had happened again, you know, in the late 90s and the early 2000s when the wrestling business had started to bottom out for WWF at that time. You know, it started to create interest in other companies and other avenues like ECW, which, you know, brought them to a national prominence and, you know, allowed the door for WCW to start to actually compete with WWF at that time.
Was that around when every wrestler was like a profession based? Like there was the surgeon.
It was shortly I'd say shortly thereafter. So you have to understand, too, that even then, you know, the reason that football, baseball, and basketball have enormous audiences is because we've all played them as kids. That's why hockey has a larger audience in Canada than it does in the United States. More people have played hockey. That's why soccer is more popular all over the rest of the world than it is in the United States. And that's why soccer is becoming more popular and more prominent and more of an interest in the World Cup is because more generations of young kids have been playing it here. Professional wrestling, physically, no one in the audience really relates to what we do on a physical level. The ring is made of steel and 2x8s and just a little bit of padding. And, you know, the remark that I hear whenever anybody actually gets in is, oh, my God, this is really hard. So they all assume it's a trampoline or a mattress when it could be nothing further from the truth. And back in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s, you know, Vince had taken that probably a little too far with having everyone having some kind of vocation, you know, where you had, you know, Duke the Dumpster Dozy and, you know, Isaac Yankum, to name a very ugly few, as far as, you know, but he was trying his best to, you know, allow the audience to relate to the person who they were, because that's all really a wrestling audience relates to, is who they are and why they're doing what they're doing, not what they physically actually are doing.
Al, a question I have, you mentioned it in the book, and I wanted to know how the whole thing worked. You were talking about how you were heating White Castles up on the engine of your car.
Yeah, only once in White Castle. I can't handle those. Those were pretty rough.
I mean,
we had a sausage and Spam and, you know, the Stewart sandwiches from the, you know, the gas stations and stuff.
Do you pull over to the side of the road and let it sit there for a while? Or, I mean, are we talking like it's sitting on the engine while you're driving down the highway?
You attach it with muffler tape and, you know, drive for a little ways.
And it doesn't catch any, like, weird fumes or anything? This doesn't seem hygienic. This seems...
Well, you got it in a, you know, you got a Boy Scout mess kit. I mean, so you know, the mess kits are two metal pans, and they have a metal strap with a wing nut that you close it up with, and then it's closed. So, you know, it keeps the engine fumes from getting in there. So,
and you also briefly mentioned,
very sterile, you know.
But I feel like there has to be more story there. You briefly mentioned that a vengeful ex tried to frame you for murder.
Yeah, that was a big mistake, and that was, you know, I've got more stories like that, but that are close to the thing, but not as bad as that. Where it was a bad situation and a lot of bad choices, and I take responsibility for my part in it. And,
were you like brought in for questioning? Did they really think you did it?
The police officer, the detective, showed up at my house and you know, knocked on the door and introduced himself, and then proceeded to explain why he was there. And they found a car alongside the highway on I-75 and just north of Hamilton, Ohio, and the windows were busted out, and there was blood all inside the car, and they couldn't find her.
And a note, you know, that said Al did it?
There was evidence that she was coming to see me, and that her family had attested to that. And so I was under investigation from there.
I imagine that in your career and just kind of living the lifestyle, right, of a wrestler, you probably picked up a lot of interesting people like that along the way.
Well, you do meet a lot of interesting people, and, you know, you have a lot of interesting interactions and experiences. And as you get older, I mean, you start to realize, you know, your part and your responsibility in it, and the choices that you make, and, you know, and realizing that a lot of people are, they're drowning in life. You know, they see you as the light at the end of the tunnel, and they don't care if it's an oncoming train or not. You know, they're going underwater, and if they have to, they'll drag you with them.
That does seem to be something that you bring up is that, like, in your earlier tenures in WWE before you, like, really caught on, like, you blamed yourself a lot and said that you were kind of a bummer, and that probably played a part in, like, maybe not.
Oh, I blamed everyone else.
At the time, but now in retrospect, you look back at it. Yeah. And see your own.
Yeah, I look back and see, knowing what I know now, and having some distance, I understand where I made mistakes, and I could have, you know, I always tell my students, the people that are young guys and young women I train now, I'm like, you know, look to yourself, because you are the one thing that you can control.
Right.
You can't control anyone else in life, but you can control yourself, and you can control how you react to things, and you know, you can make that decision. No one, you know, the big myth in life is that someone makes you happy, or someone makes you sad, or someone makes you angry. They do behavior, and then you choose. You have the choice, the freedom to decide whether or not you're going to let it make you angry, or, you know, you can decide how it's going to make you feel.
Do you feel like this introspection and this these realizations, is that what drove you to write your story?
What drove me to write my story, quite frankly, was enough people continued to tell me that I had a story to write, and that people might actually find it interesting, which I myself didn't think that was possible. And they, you know, but they just continued to hound me and suggest that I do it. And so I thought, you know, I will, but I'm going to write it from the perspective of, one, I'm going to tell my experiences, and I'm going to tell my story, and I'm going to try and be as honest and own and be responsible for what I've done and the choices I've made. And two, I'm not going to be dark. I'm not going to be bitter. I'm not going to try to be hateful. I'm going to try to, you know, show that I really, truly feel blessed to have gotten to do what I love to do so much for as long as I've gotten to do it. And I cannot be more grateful for every bad thing, every negative thing, every positive thing. None of them matter. All that matters is that I have gotten enough experiences, amazing, incredible experiences, through the wonderful gift of being able to pursue what I dreamed of pursuing, that now give me the ability to tell amazing stories that most people would never believe, if, you know. You know, and a lot of people still don't. You know, I tell some of the stories I tell in the book, and, you know, to people, and all the time, and they just start laughing, and they're like, there's no way, this can't be real. And I'm like, it is real. And, you know, and it happens all the time in the world of professional wrestling. And, you know, I'm very blessed. I've gotten to live an adventure. I've gotten to go places, see things, do things, meet people. I've been on 6 continents. All I have to do is fly to Antarctica, get off the plane, put my feet down, and I've been on every continent on the face of this earth. You know, I grew up in a small Midwestern town called Lima, Ohio, in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, and I pursued a dream, and I've been able to, you know, to go to Iceland and all over Germany and, you know, France and Italy and, you know, India, Japan, Costa Rica, Puerto Rico. I mean, you know, every state in the union except Alaska so far, Chile, the list goes on. And that's all because I've been a professional wrestler. I've gotten to go and see and do things that people only read about in books or see on the internet. I've been on, like, 5 different safaris in South Africa.
Do you feel like you've hit every touchstone that 14-year-old kid with stars in his eyes had when he said, this is what I'm going to do with my life? Do you feel like you've hit every one of those beats, and you think that 14-year-old kid would be proud of you?
That's deep, Travis.
I think that I have achieved the 3 goals that I wanted to achieve when I first got in the wrestling business. And quite honestly, they were to be able to make a living doing what I love to do. That was the goal, that I be able to do this and nothing else. Have matches and moments that people would remember, and make an impact on the wrestling business where people would remember my name. And, you know, in my opinion, at least, which is what matters because that you asked me.
Well, absolutely.
I think I've done that. You know, and there's still plenty more to do, and there's still plenty more to achieve. You know, I bought OVW last year, and, you know, I have always believed that my legacy in the wrestling business will be those that I've taught and given the abilities to pursue their dreams, and make the wrestling business better for it. And I would be happy if that were my only legacy. If I had no other legacy but that, I'd be thrilled.
Guys, the memoir is Self-Help, Life Lessons from the Bizarre Wrestling Career of Al Snow.
I hope people read it and enjoy it, and I hope that they see another side of the wrestling business. That it's not always this dark, gloomy, like I have this cross to bear because I became a professional wrestler. And, you know, so many books, they all seem to come across that way, and I just wanted mine to seem like, you know, like what it is. It's just, you know.
So you think most of them sound like kind of regretful almost?
No, I don't think regretful. I think a lot of wrestlers want to over dramatize or make it darker, you know, because we're so maligned as a entertainment form of entertainment, as an art form of physical storytelling. We're maligned by the rest of, you know, entertainment of, you know, which is absurd considering the amounts of money on a, you know, that we have over decades, you know, as an entertainment business have been able to continuously draw, but we're still treated like the redheaded stepchild, you know, the carny version of entertainment. And when nothing could be further from the truth. And I think the performers inside of it are so desperate for mainstream acceptance and respect for what is done that they try to show the burden, the cost, of the wrestling business and its in the pursuit of it, as opposed to the quite honestly. Guys, I can tell you, there ain't no better way to make a living as a grown man because you don't have to grow up. You literally go out and, you know, there are the negatives, but you get to be a rock star. You get to be an action hero. You get to be a soap opera star. You get to be an all-star athlete on an all-star team playing in the, you know, for the NFL in the Super Bowl or for the Major League Baseball in the World Series or, you know, you get to be all these amazing things. You get to be a superhero, your live action comic book character, all wrapped up in one night. And all you got to do is go out there and fake find another man in his underwear for money. And you'd be amazed at how many of the guys in the back are doing nothing but complaining about the plight of their situation. And it's like, guys, you wanted to do this. You're the one that said, oh, I'll do anything to be here. And now you're doing nothing but bitching about it. This is awesome.
Is there something to that in everything, though? Because it seems like a victim is like to be the sympathetic character that...
You to be the martyr. Yeah, you got to be a martyr. And that's why I think a lot of other, you know, not the other wrestling stories are great. I just think that a lot take that tact of I'm a martyr for doing it. It's like, you know what? I'm not. I'm lucky. Man, I could not be more grateful or more blessed or more happy or more thankful or you name the word for what I have gotten to do, see, and experience. And I'd be nothing but thrilled if 20 years from now I'm still doing it and I got even more ridiculous stories to tell people. And nobody else gives a shit or cares to buy a book or want to hear from me. I'll just sit in my living room and bother my kids with it.
Well, I got to say, it's a very profound thing that you've never lost sight of what you were able to do, throughout your career and continue to have in your career. And, that you never got jaded by the thing. And that's a real admirable thing.
Well, I think that, the older veterans, I think the reason they become bitter, that they become jaded, is I think they're jealous. I think that they are jealous of the next generation that are now living in that spotlight that they used to be in. And they're getting to do and live that high that they no longer can get, you know.
Well, I guess once you get that taste, you want to keep getting it.
Oh, it's hard. I mean, it's the most addictive drug there is. It really is. NFL, in fact, the NFL just instituted a program to teach its football players how to live a life off the field, you know, once their career comes to an end. And that's part of too why I've created, you know, we've got our provisional approval from the proprietary office of state education for the first ever wrestling trade school, so that we can teach these young people skills and that they'll be able to have a career and function once their in-ring career ends.
Wow.
Excellent.
So guys, again, self-help. Life Lessons from the Bizarre Wrestling Career of Al Snow. It's on Amazon now. Al, what's the best place to direct people to get the book? Just Amazon?
I would say Amazon's probably the primary place. It's the best right now. It's you know, hallelujah, thank Jeebus and Allah and Buddha and every other single person out there that it is number one on the you know, wrestling. Biographies and
congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really shocked and really surprised and very flattered and just ecstatic. I really am that it's been well received, and I hope people genuinely just enjoy it, you know, and you know, get a kick out of the goofy stories. There are a lot of really ridiculous stories. I didn't even have enough time to tell all of them. So
I can imagine. Yeah.
It's a volume two. I smell a volume two.
We'll see. This one took a year to put together, so we'll see about another one.
All right. Al, we appreciate it. We'll do it again sometime. Take care.
Yes, thank you guys very much. Have a nice evening.
Thanks, Al. You too,
Travis. That Al Snow. I'll tell you what. I like that Al Snow.
Me too.
Good guy. He likes his life. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that really like that does life. That does say something. You know, it's when you do see guys, you know, like I said, to him, jaded by, you know, successes and where they were.
Yeah,
I'm realizing what they had.
I'm reading the book and throughout it, like he's saying, yeah, this is, you know, I was being kind of a dick here. You know, I was in the WWF and that was a big deal. And, you know, what they would do is he would, like you'd go into Vince's office and Vince would be like, your name's, Shinobi and you're a ninja, go to wardrobe and get your ninja character. And then like, he'd go there and they'd give him like he was a ninja for a while. Al Snow was a goddamn ninja named, what was his fucking name? He was a ninja guy for a while, Travis, and he wore like a ninja mask. And the whole reason was Vince McMahon saw that Mortal Kombat was popular and that like people liked Scorpion and Sub-Zero. So they're like, yeah, let's have a Scorpion Sub-Zero. You're a ninja guy. And so Al Snow was going out there fucking being the ninja guy who had a mask on the whole time. And he was pissed off. He was like, dude, this is bullshit. I don't want to wear a mask. And then he was like, you know, in retrospect, I should have embraced my ninja character and been the best goddamn ninja I could be.